Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Windgap. There's a murder there. Another one's missing now. Get me a story.
Dad, Mama, goodness, I didn't expect you. The house is not up to par for visitors. I'm just in town on business.
What kind of person does that? Hurt a child.
Doesn't help anything. Riling folks up.
You got two mutilated girls on your hands. Someone else is doing the riling.
I didn't come back to cause any problems. Everything you do comes back on me.
Mama says I need to be careful around you.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Sharp Objects, an unofficial podcast about the HBO series Sharp Objects. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Each week we break down the latest episode and occasionally feature interviews with people who worked on the show. Last week we had the great Elizabeth Perkins, aka Jackie. This week we will be talking to Detective Dick himself, Chris Messina.
Detective Dick indeed.
In every way. And at the end of the episode, we will be diving into a spoiler section that's for book readers only. But before we get to any of that, we're going to take a spoiler-free look at the Mike Nichols film Closer, starring Jude Law, Natalie Portman, Julia Roberts, and Clive Owen. That's why we're here.
Yeah.
Right, Richard?
Can't wait. We're going to talk about, I forgot the guy's name who sings the song at the end.
Damien Rice.
Damien Rice. Yeah. Oh, man.
No, okay. We're here to talk about episode 5, Sharp Objects, titled Closer, directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, written by Scott Brown. Before we, you know, sort of get into our little like beat by beat breakdown of the episode, which I thought this was a really good episode, we want to address a few factual errors and read an email that we got. Richard, I was playing a drinking game this week of like every time we got a tweet or an email about missing this blood stain for our favorite character, Ashley, I got to take a little drink. So I've been trashed all week.
Waste.
We got a lot of corrections. We missed that Ashley, John Keane's girlfriend, Little Miss Perfect Ashley, was using that bleach to clean up a blood spot that she found on the carpet. And we like went off on this whole tangent about how it was like a symbolic of her cleaning her dirty sexuality or whatever. When in fact she was just doing some light, blood stain cleaning like you do in Windgap. So that is something that we missed that some of you told us about nicely. Some of you told us about a little more, not less nicely.
I guess like in the context of the show, it would suggest that Ashley doesn't necessarily, it's possible she thinks that he did it. she's willing to accept that possibility.
Right. And in this episode, she says to Camille, like, I know things. You don't want to burn this bridge. So, you know, She knows how to get bloodstains out of carpets. That's always useful. We were also wrong about Calhoun Day. I mean, not wrong. We were just like kind of guessing that maybe Calhoun Day would be like, I think we might have done this in the spoiler section. We were guessing like that Calhoun Day would be the penultimate episode, that something big would happen at Calhoun Day. And you know, it was a nice like boiling point episode, but, it wasn't like the finale that we were sort of hoping or thinking it would be, but I really liked it. Especially as it acts as, you know, with the exception of like a few field trips, it acts as kind of a bottle episode,
yeah.
On the lawn, which I really, really liked. So, is there anything you want to say about the episode, like as a whole, before we sort of break it down?
Well, I think we were going to read an email from a listener, right? About the kind of southernness of Missouri, which I feel like really speaks to this episode.
Absolutely. Yeah. We were wondering before whether or not Missouri counted as like a southern state. There was a debate about like, you know, why is this Confederate soldier such a big, part of Missouri? Is Missouri a southern state? We got an email from a listener. Andrea writes in and says, hey there. I really enjoy the podcast for the entertaining and in-depth perspective a female and gay-identified male provide. I am by no means an expert on television or media in general, so I appreciate providing the everyday commoner breakdown for week by week. To answer your inquiry presented during the latest episode about if Missouri is considered part of the Dixie South, it absolutely is. By today's standards, St. Louis is one of the most, if not the most, racially segregated cities in the entire United States. The Missouri Compromise was the prequel to the beginning of the Civil War. This legislation was basically an understanding between the North and South that no more slavery states would be permitted into the Union, but wait, we'll allow just this one more exception to appease radically growing tensions within the federal government over slavery. Michael Brown's death and the creation of the Black Lives Matter movement was the culmination of generations of institutionalized racism, Jim Crow, and generational trauma passed on from Black family to Black family. It is very much a part of the South and remains a battleground to this day. I really like that perspective from Andrea. And of course, in this episode, we get so many Confederate flags, but then also this interesting line from Camille where she says, we don't use the C word, Confederacy, in Missouri. What did you think of like the way in which the location of Missouri, obviously like Sharp Objects was published before, some of the major protests that happened, in Ferguson and St. Louis. But like, what do you think of Missouri as emblematic of something larger in our country, Richard?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. And I think that, you know, it kind of helps explain Gillian Flynn's kind of continual fascination with that part of the country. I mean, granted she's from there, but you know, she's set a number of her stories there. And, you know, I think that sort of added foundational tension, that foundational oppression, you know, just adds that much more text and sort of context and, grimness to, you know, this kind of surface story. And I think that while, you know, Missouri's original sin in the real world, is what it is in terms of slavery, Calhoun, or Widgap rather, you know, we see with Calhoun Day, like, has its own, not original sin exactly, but like a weird, troubled history of, you know, going back to its, you know, beginnings of like how it views women. And, you know, so I think that both Missouri and Widgap are places very much informed by the, cruelty of their, beginnings.
Yeah, I love that idea of this. I mean, maybe not original sin, but just sort of this, like, the foundation myth of, of Widgap is tied up in sexual assault and, like, more specifically, female silence around sexual assault. The thing that I was maybe going to bring this up later, but I think it's maybe worth bringing up now. So I went back and double checked. I know that you guys are going to be honest if we make any book errors at all, but like the name Millie Calhoun is never mentioned, in the book. Millie Calhoun is not a figure in the book. As I think I mentioned last week, the figure of her husband, Calhoun, Zeke Calhoun, right? He is mentioned, but like this whole foundation myth of Wind Gap or whatever you want to call it is not part of the book. So it's invented for the show, and something that like didn't occur to me until the third time through. I was like word searching through my Kindle app for the word Millie to make sure I didn't miss it. And then I was like, well, maybe they spell it differently than what I'm thinking. So I just like shortened it to M-I-L-L. And I realized that in the book, Emma calls Camille, she calls her like Meal, like, or Millie. I don't know how you would pronounce it, but M-I-L-L-E is like a nickname that Emma has for Camille. And that's when it occurred to me, and it hadn't, that Millie is a nickname for Camille, can be. Also like Amelia and a bunch of other names, but it can be a nickname for Camille. So like the fact that they have created this character of Millie Calhoun and the fact that she has the nickname that could apply to our main character is something that I think is kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
And then of course that Camille has like had a sexual, I would call it a sexual assault, and her silence around that is something that is very foundational to her and who she is. So. All right. So let us go back to the beginning. This episode does the same thing as last week's episode, where it picks up immediately sort of where it left off with some of these like, Emma caught in the headlights and Camille thinking about her in the hunting cabin with her teeth pulled out. It's unclear sort of like what happened if at the end of that night, like did Camille find Emma and just like pop her in the Volvo and take her home, or did she just like wind up going home after all that? It's unclear, but like basically Emma's home safe and sound, Camille's in her bed waking up, and that's how we start this lovely Calhoun day.
Yeah, and once again, you know, there's she's hearing like when in the kind of dream thing where she's out driving, there's this kind of persistent little ticking noise. And then when she wakes up, we realize it's someone, you know, hammering in a tent stake or whatever outside. So it's just like, again, valet, like doing that really good kind of blending. And it's really neat.
Yeah. And you can also hear, if you watch it again, you can also hear, like Emma's running her lines for the pageant, and you can hear those lines, over those dream shots. And they're the lines. They're the, like, what Millie Calhoun says as she's being sexually assaulted by the soldiers. Like those are the lines that Emma's running as she's like giggling and like roller skating on the porch with her friends. You also hear the song that the really powerful song closes the episode, Palante by, Hurry for the Riff Raff. Camille's listening to it at the beginning of the episode and at the end of the episode. So it's a nice little musical bookend. But then we see Alan and Adora getting ready. This is an amazing thing about this episode. I can't tell how much it is like valet messing with the editing, or just does Adora have two looks for this day? Cause she's got this like peachy dress that she puts on at the beginning of the day, but is not what she winds up wearing.
She has a costume change.
Yeah, exactly. We've got Alan saying this thing where he's like, this day is about celebrating what's like immovable about this place and about us, which is like such a, uncomfortable to me, like regressive. What's the like really toxic phrase that people use to talk about, protecting Confederate monuments, sort of our, I don't know.
I don't know, honoring history or whatever, like.
Honoring history, whatever that is. And that's what it feels like to me. Weird milk, mealy-mouthed way of talking about honoring the Confederacy. So, yeah. And then we get this like first, curry call. We get two curry calls in this episode. We get this first curry call, and Camille is a viral hit, Richard.
Yeah. She you know, people are really interested in this, you know, these two murdered young women in a creepy town. Isn't that strange that big city people would read that article and be like, want more of it?
Yeah, we're not ghouls at all. But yeah, so Curry says that this article, the latest one that published on Calhoun Day, is getting the website more page views than they've ever gotten in their entire lives. So there you go. And Camille is like a little worried about it, but she gets much more worried about it later. And then we get this great sequence, which is the first of several that has to do with this like crazy floor that's in, Adora's room. We've seen it before. This isn't the first time, but like we get this great flashback as, Camille drops her water bottle into her mom's room and is like afraid to go get it because she's afraid to go into this room. And we get this flashback of a photographer taking a photo of the floor. What did you think of this whole sequence?
Yeah, I thought it was, you know, interesting. And I think that Amy Adams did a really good job of subtle, but, you know, really on point physical acting where you could see, like, Camille, like, there was so much muscle memory just restraining her from even, you know, stepping a toe over that the door jamb, you know. And like, I feel like we all have some sort of, you know, aversion built into us as children that, like, you know, that doing it, you know, kind of going against it, even though we as adults now are like, eh, whatever, like, it would just be some sort of violation. So anyway, I thought that was really well articulated. And I also thought it was interesting, you know, just another sort of layer of this portrait of young Camille's or Camille's sort of sexual past where she's, you know, kind of making eyes at this photographer and he back at her. And so there was just this ever sort of present feeling of, I don't know, I don't want to, danger, I guess, but like it's more kind of like illicit sort of enticement.
Yeah. And like the theme of watching, which is like so prevalent in this episode, and like wanting to be noticed and jealousy of someone else being noticed. You know what I mean? Like, because part of the reason that Camille gets in trouble here is she tracks a muddy footprint or two into the room, but also because the photographer is watching her and not paying as much attention to Adora as I think Adora would want.
Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. As Adora is giving this like crazy family history, we find out that her mother was a Calhoun. She married a Preaker. The Preakers had the money. The Calhouns had the house. And like Adora says something like, there was soldier's blood on this floor and on all this stuff like that. Adora has her high heels on in this scene, like walking around this room, but the photographer does not have his shoes on. And then later when like Dick and Adora go in there, neither of them have their shoes on. So this whole like thing of like shoes and at this floor, this crazy floor, which, you know, is like Tusk's sort of whittled down. But I like to think about this as like the floor is another sharp object, basically. Like these are sharp tusks that have been softened. One little detail I like, you know, you see the Southern Living article that's up framed in the room. Of course, it's just Marion in the photo with Adora. Mm-hmm. Camille was not asked to be in that photo. But the headline on the article is Legacy in Ivory, which I guess is a fun, zippy Ebony and Ivory pun. In the book, the headline was Ivory Toast. So I think they punched it up a little bit.
Yeah. And also like changing Ebony to Legacy.
Yes.
Like it just, you know, further reinforces the fucked upness of this community and this particular day.
Absolutely. And I did like, it was very brief, but I like the glimpses that we see of Marion and Camille and their relationship as kids and like how cute they're being, like goofing around with each other, how important it was for them to have this like sisterly bond with each other, especially for Camille, who felt so cut off from love. And like Marion's her one source of love in that house, you know? Or whatever feeble thing that Alan can offer her. And so when we get later stuff with Emma saying like, don't tell mama, like that's this like, you know, sort of semblance of sisterly intimacy that Emma's offering her, though of course it comes with like, you know, all these other thorns, but like I can understand why Camille continually gets sucked back into the Emma stuff because of her, of that, as you said, like earlier foundational relationship with Marion, you know.
So. Yeah.
And then we see like Camille ignoring a call from Dick, who's the first to point out that maybe this wasn't the best day to publish that article, where she basically like points to Bob Nash and John Keane as the two main suspects. We get Vickery and Dick encountering each other in the shave shop, and I like to point out that Detective Dick seems to literally have one dress shirt, just that one dark blue number, unless he has like a whole closet full of the same shirt. So I don't know. Is there anything about the like Vickery Dick conversation that you felt worth digging into?
I mean, I think it's just like, I guess I kind of like the show expanding on this rivalry, you know, in creating a sort of more tension because it's a TV show, blah, 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 blah. I don't want much more time spent on it, though. You know, like, we get it. They're antagonizers, but they both, you know, want to crack the case, whatever. Like, I think that it's been stated, you know, enough, and I think that we can go back to the ladies.
I do like that, Vickery, like, Vickery's so wrong, right? He calls, Camille a bad apple from a good tree.
Yeah, and it's funny that, like, I mean, again, we're like watching it from the outside, but like, how could anyone spend any time with Adora and be like, oh, she's great? You know?
That lady rules.
She's demonstrably not. We see it later when she's talking to the ladies on the veranda. It's just like, she's not a nice person.
No. But like, but right before she talks to the ladies on the veranda, she just lays the sugar on those children there. Yeah. So it's interesting. Camille says she'll run line with Emma. Once again, this is the rape scene. Like, we get to hear it a couple times before we get to see it. This Calhoun pageant rape scene. It works. This episode really works. But like, if you take one half step back, it is insane that there is a day where the entire town sits around and watches the reenactment of the rape of a young woman. And like, that's the point, obviously, but it's still like, it's crazy that it doesn't feel completely, like science fiction while you're watching it. You know what I mean?
Right. So. Yeah.
Adora decides that Camille needs a dress, and she goes, we're going to do a field trip, just us girls. And then she goes, do you hear that, Alan? Yeah. Alan, who winds up being their chauffeur on the girls only field trip. That was a nice little juxtaposition of a line. And this is where we find out about Emma's second phone, and Emma is super pissed to learn about the article. I feel like she's most pissed that, like, she didn't know about the article first. That's what struck me. What did you think?
Yeah, that she had to be told about it, you know, and like, she's so bored in this town, and like, you know, it's scary and dark stuff that's happening, but it's something interesting. And I think that, you know, given that she should have access to the kind of center of the story because her sister's there writing about it, she doesn't, you know? And so, you know, she clearly seems betrayed, and we see that later in the episode, during the little performance. You know, so she's just somebody who like is very sensitive and like does not like feeling like she has been at all sort of discounted or, looked over.
And I think, you know, you can see how she gets that directly from Adora, because I feel like the whole let's get Camille a dress field trip is Adora punishing Camille. Like, I don't know. She seems to be punishing Camille for like, Emma wanting to run lines with Camille. It's like anytime someone diverts attention away from Adora or away from Emma, those two women find a way to like punish everyone around them, you know? And, so this, I mean, it feels like a punishing field trip, to be honest with you. But, what is interesting, you mentioned the sound design of the episode, like, you know, and like, obviously we like to talk about the hog heat of Wind Gap, but like, this is the hog heatiest episode, I think, so far. The sound of the cicadas, the sound of like the meat sizzling, everything in this episode just like makes me feel, overheated.
Yeah. Everyone's day drunk, you know, which is a particular feeling, kind of bleary and
Everyone's like sweaty and day drunk, but before we get to that, we get this weird little like hermetically sealed moment in the Krellen family car with Alan driving. The AC's blasting. The doors are sealed. The light is like blue, and everything is like a little different in this little contained box. And, I just thought that was an interesting juxtaposition of like what we'll get later, all the noise we get later. And then this little like Perry Cuomo singing, as they're driving into town.
This kind of like Alan's like crooning music, and like, and Adora kind of casts this like loving gaze back into the back seat, not just at Emma. It almost looks like she's looking at Camille too. I don't know. It is a strange kind of like dreamy little interlude. That, you know, forgets the outside world for a second.
Right. And it feels like Adora's like, my perfect family, like my picture perfect family, even though we know she doesn't feel that way about Camille, really. We get more complaints from her about her hand as she goes to the shop. I love, like, the idea here is like the shop owner has opened the shop for Adora, basically a dork and command the shop to be open for her. And even as this is happening for her, she's bitching about the grate that this woman has to like roll back because the shop was closed. The woman has to like open it for her. And she's like, oh, this grate is so unattractive. I can't believe people feel like they need to do this, you know?
Yeah. Sort of thing. Poor Sarah Beth.
Poor Sarah Beth. And she says this weird, Adora says this weird shit about Camille's father. She's like, yeah, she gets her looks from her father and her temperament too. And Camille's like, and this is ripped exactly from the book where Camille's like, that's the most I ever heard about my father. And there's this great part in the book where Camille says like, I wonder if she told like what she's told other shop owners and if I should go to like all the shop owners of Windgap and try to like put together a sketchy portrait of like who my dad is based on things that they've been told. But they're shopping for these dresses. This is like, okay, so we've talked about Eliza Scanlon and I think how great she is in this role. But like the weird little puppy dog whines that she gives in this scene when she's not getting all the attention she wants. It's amazing.
She's so annoying in this scene, like the character, you know, when like Camille is like, please wait in the car, please wait in the car. And she just like won't go. And you're just like, aha, this kid is like such a nuisance in a way, but like well played, obviously, but like, I found this scene incredibly stressful.
Oh my God. So stressful. And the fact that it ends. So like, you know, once again, this is directly from the book. And if you want to read a little bit more about this scene, our colleague Julie Miller has an interview with, Amy Adams, makeup artist, about sort of some of the scarring that we see. Cause we see like, I think our most in-depth look at the scarring on her body and the extent of the damage. And so you can find that on vf.com right now if you want to, but, what did you think of the reveal? Like, was it worse than you imagined? Was it what you were imagining? And how do you feel like, they pulled it off?
I think they did a good job. I mean, when I read the book, long time ago, I remember thinking that, like, the whole gimmick of her carving words on herself was, like, a little bit, not believable in a way. Like, maybe that's true. Maybe people do that. And I apologize if I'm being, like, flippant about it. I don't mean to be. I just mean, like, it just seemed like kind of a device. And I think that it's been pretty subtly employed on the show. Like, I'm happy with that. And I think that, like, the way that they got her to look like it felt very real, which made it all the more stressful, you know? And, like, you know, Emma's reaction wasn't to scream in horror, nor was Adora's. It was like they were certainly put off and, you know, sort of horrified by it, but it wasn't like, you know, she wasn't a monster.
Right. There is, and there's some like, there's like a weird beauty to it. You know what I mean? Don't mean to like, I don't want to like glamorize a serious issue, nor do I want to like, you know, make anyone who's listening to this, who has cut like feel ostracized. I don't want to do either of those things, but that is the like the weird, or I would say like tricky needle, that this episode's trying to thread. The trickiness of that particular design, makeup design of like, I think you are meant to find it, like it's different than what we saw on Alice's body. I feel like when Alice held up her skirt, when her roommate Alice held up her skirt and earlier, and you see the cuts on her legs, like this just looks different. And we get that in the following scene when Emma is like, I know someone like you will not like you. You know what I mean? Like she cuts, but she cuts differently than other people cut, you know? And so I think that that's like a really interesting reveal. And, of course, Adora says the most venomous thing. I mean, first of all, she's in this position because Emma stole her clothes. Great. And then, you know, Adora says, you're ruined. And also like, and you did this out of spite. Basically, like her damage is about Adora. And of course it is about Adora, but Adora like makes it as much about her as the cut on her hand is about her.
Yeah.
You know what
I mean? And she also says to Camille, it's worse than I remember. And then Camille says, you were there toward the end, meaning like, you know how bad it got and you still let me go into this dressing room with these dresses, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and so obviously, like you said, this was a punishment. She wanted this to happen. She says as much. She's like, I'm glad she saw.
Yeah.
And so she's, yeah, it's just like a really cruel thing to do. And it's a long punishment. I mean, they had to get in the car and go there. She had to call Sarah Beth and have Sarah Beth open the store on Calhoun Day.
Just so she could humiliate her daughter. And so then that casts a different light maybe on that car scene where it's like, maybe she looks so pleased because she knows she's about to like lead her into this trap. I mean, it's just awful. You know, and then we get this great moment of Amy Adams screaming into the dress, and it's just, it's so well done. Like, Amy Adams has been great throughout this whole thing, but I think this eruption and then, some of the vulnerability we see from her at the very end of the episode, like, I think it's some of the best work that she's done so far.
Totally.
Something that I thought was so fascinating about your conversation with Elizabeth Perkins last week, was this discussion of the levels, the modulation and level of sound of people talking in the show.
Mm-hmm.
She was saying that, like, this, that Jean-Marc Vallée keeps the set kind of quiet, and as a result, people wind up almost like whispering their lines in the show. And so when someone is loud, like Jackie is loud, then it's like more alarming than it might otherwise be. And so when like Jackie is loud, or if, you know, even muffled, if Camille screams, that feels like, you know, even more of a violation of this calm, quiet, disturbing environment that Adora has crafted around her.
Yeah, you know? Totally.
All right. And then we get, you know, we're almost to actual Calhoun Day, but then we get this like last scene with Emma and Camille, where great line where Emma's talking about a girl she knows who cuts, and Camille's like, oh, she sounds like an after school special. And Emma says, what's that? And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, after school, so that was like 70s and 80s, right? Early 80s and 70s.
Yeah, I think they had them up through the early mid 90s, like sporadically. But yeah, it was mostly an invention of the 70s and 80s, I think.
Right. I feel like in the 90s, it became like the very special episode was something that sort of like came over. Basically, like after school specials. I mean, I know most people listening know this, but like after school specials were like these, televised thing that dealt with a certain issue. The one that I always think of is there's one like that's about, I believe, Angel Dust or PCP that Helen Hunt was in. So mm-hmm. Very young Helen Hunt. It is on YouTube if you want to like, see something kind of amazing, but they're these sort of overwrought, over the top, kind of tone deaf, out of touch with the kids, treatments of certain issues. So for Emma to say like, this is how the girl that I know, like, this is how she talks about cutting. Camille's like, yeah, that sounds like both textbook and like, you know, not very applicable to my situation, yeah. I guess, sort of how that feels. And basically, like, you know, Emma begs her to stay, and then she gives her a dress that will work. She just happens to have a long-skirted dress ready to go.
But still, like, distressingly sort of sheer, and like they're a little like, you know, hole, it's lacy, they're like little holes cut out, and I was like, oh, is that going to cover enough? I mean, you see later that she's wearing tights, but anyway, yeah, it's funny to see her in this kind of regalia, because it, like, to basically dress in the costuming of the house, because obviously she's been so resistant to that otherwise, so I think that also sets this episode at an interesting sort of pitch, that like she, like Vickery is in costume for this day, and how that affects how she acts.
Yeah, and she's wearing these like thick white tights.
Yeah,
like in all that hog heat.
Yeah.
It's just, it looks so uncomfortable. And she pairs it with like this little hat and stuff like that. And she has her second Curry call where she talks about like wanting to leave, and he basically like he's like, you can come home if you want.
Yeah.
And she does this thing that I love where she's like, he's like, how are you doing? She's like, not great, but I guess that's not your, like, any of your concern. And that is like, oh, I like recognize that so much of like, it's someone who wants someone to tell them that they care, but like positioned as like, you don't care how I feel, sort of thing. And then she says this other thing where she's like, being here, I feel like a bad person. And she just breaks down as she says it. And it's like, For those of us who have challenging relationship with our parents, like, that is exactly what being home can feel like.
Yeah, and know? it's such a perfectly articulate line, in that I think something that was not as smart as this would be like, you know, I hate being here because my mom sucks or whatever. You know, I have bad memories of something that happened to me. But the feeling of, I feel like she's taking on the weight of it, you know, she's like believing Adora's assessment of her, the town's assessment of her. And it's not because she's weak-willed exactly. It's just because it's so built into her. And this idea that, like, okay, well, then maybe when she goes to home to St. Louis, she doesn't feel like a bad person, but she's clearly in bad shape there too. So I don't know. I just think it's a really, sensitive and, accurate, sentiment for her to express at that moment. Like, it's not melodramatic. I think it's exactly like what she would be thinking and feeling.
And this is the number that Adora has, I completely agree with you, and this is the number that Adora has done on her in terms of, like, it goes back to that line that we, like, bristled at where it's like, look what you did when the thorn cuts Adora's palm. And, like, so Camille feels like the kind of person who cuts herself out of spite to upset her mother, or tracks a muddy footprint onto an ivory floor, or somehow prompts a rose to slice her mother's palm open. Like, she feels like a mistake, like a bad person throughout. And it's just, it's so, I find it completely relatable. But,
and Adora says to both girls, I think in the store, she's like, you made me bleed. Like, she's like, you know, cause the cut reopens or whatever. And like, not to get like too whatever about it, but like, mothers do inherently bleed for their children, you know, and that is not something that that mothers or parents should make their, not all mothers obviously have birth or, you know, to their children, but like give birth to their children. But like, you know, it's like Adora always putting this onus on especially Camille, but also, you know, on Emma a little bit, to sort of apologize for any sort of discomfort they've given her, when that's like kind of the enterprise of being a parent. I mean, it's just very telling.
Yeah, I love all of this. And this is what leads us into the actual Calhoun Day stuff. Which is, and like, once again, I don't know who out there is like rewatching Sharp Objects, but if you rewatch the episode, or maybe you notice this the first time, almost every single establishing shot of a character then has a following shot of another character watching them.
Yeah, totally.
It's like almost every single thing. And so, like, you know, if you've got Camille walking to the house with Dick, you then see Jackie watching Camille walking into the house with Dick. Or if you see Bob Nash taking a swig from his flask, you then see Vickery watching Bob Nash take a swig from his flask. And it's like, it's insane. And like, we keep talking about how Jean-Marc Vallée must have this like intricate yarn wall of like edits and cuts, but it's even harder when it's all this web that he's created within this one setting. You know what I mean? You flash out very infrequently, and mostly it's about him drawing these connections between, like, it's a web, basically, you know? I kind of want to subtitle this episode Jocelyn Knows, because Vickery's wife Jocelyn, like, if we feel sorry for Sarah Beth, I think we feel even worse for Jocelyn, who like definitely knows. The implication seems even stronger in this episode that Vickery and Adora like are having some kind of relationship. The thing that actually pings that for me is, you know, like we were kind of questioning it. They seem like oddly intimate in last week's episode, but the thing that really pings it for me, is not even like the bitchy thing that Jackie says about like the Krellin girls love their men with badges. Yeah. Not even like Jocelyn being like, you look lovely as ever. It's Vickery calling Adora Miss Krellin in front of Jocelyn, and then Adora everywhere else.
Totally.
And I'm like, that's it to me. That tells me that they either are or have at least like fucked. And poor Jocelyn.
And the Jocelyn, the sort of deference that she pays to Adora, and we see it a couple more, where she's like, thank you so much for having us, and everyone thanks her. And it's like, But if, why, like, of course, like, this is the town's holiday. I know it's on her land, but like, what were people not going to go? Like, you have to go. So like, they're thanking her, but like, and it's like they're being made to. It's like,
kiss the ring.
Yeah. And there's such a sadness in that, kind of pathetic, like, you know, she's the queen, literally, in some ways, you know?
Well, yeah. And the, like, so one of the first shots we get is like Jackie and the ladies who lunch or brunch. They call themselves the Veranda Girls, 35 years running or whatever. And they like are talking shit on Adora, and then Adora shows up, and it's like immediately like, yeah, kiss the ring, like veiled sort of whatever. But yeah, you have to pay deference. Or when Katie Lacey and her little pack of like former cheerleaders, one of them starts talking about Amma. And then Katie's like, remember whose lawn you're on right now.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's exactly that. It's like, this is the queen and this is her day. I mean, every day is Adora's day.
And she's forcing everyone to be there so they yeah. can thank her for being there. You know?
Yeah. The whole Jocelyn thing reminded me of, like Prima Nocta, you know, that like,
yeah.
if you're the lord of a certain era, you get the right to anyone's bride. You can have them on their wedding night or whatever. And it's just sort of like, yeah, Jocelyn's given her husband to Adora because what else is she going to do? Adora gets to have whatever she wants. So, and then Jocelyn will thank her for the favor. So.
I believe it's also called like Droit de Seigneur or something
yeah.
like that, you know.
Yeah. Exactly.
But yeah, it's in the movie Braveheart.
Yes, that's where I learned about
yeah.
it. But yeah, so I talked before about the sound design, about like the cicadas, and it's just like ramped up to 11. It's crazy. And Messina is just like sweating through his dress shirt. There's this interaction between Bob Nash and Detective Dick where the sun is just like blazing on their faces, like full force. And like, I really imagine that in most other productions, there would be some kind of sunshade where you would like know that it was sunny, but I feel like your actors wouldn't be as much in direct sunlight as that, to the point where like Chris Messina's Detective Dick puts his hand up over his eyes to shade them, which is such like a recognizable human gesture.
Yeah.
But one that I feel like you don't see in movies that often.
No, it's true. It's true. And yeah. I think it speaks to the fact that like, you know, he's using so much natural light. Mm-hmm. That like, yeah, I mean, you use the natural light of a dim situation too, but that means you have to use the natural light of a bright one, you know?
Right. And so like these actors are just sort of baking under that. But we get all these like various interactions, you know, like the gang's all here. Even James Capici is like running around stealing bottles of pop and yeah. stuff like that. Like a little feral child. Ashley's pissed that she was left out of the article. John Keane sulk. Like basically get like shots of John Keane sulking, shots of Bob Nash drinking. Vickery's watching, Dick's watching, all of this like intricate like dancing is happening. So and then what, like, but I want to know what you think of like these trio of boys, the men, basically like Kirk Lacey's friends who are hanging out, and their interaction with Dick and Camille, and them being like, so leering and so, and then they like do this weird singing, which I love and is just so weird. Like, what do you think of all of that?
Yeah. I kind of found myself wondering a little bit if they would have been that way to her there. On that day, you know, they're pretty direct about, like, do you want to go to the woods, basically? You
right.
know, and maybe they're sort of just making a har-har kind of like old days joke. Maybe they're serious, but the way that these, like, you know, three guys kind of menace the whole afternoon, maybe feels a little bit overstated to me. But, you know, we are at episode, what is it, 5, and so we got 3 more to go. So we have to kind of ramp things up. But I thought, I did like when one of them said to Dick, you ain't in Kansas anymore, Toto.
Right.
Not Kansas City. And you're like,
right.
Does he know where Kansas City is?
Right.
I mean, part of Kansas City is in Kansas, yes. But like, it's mostly in Missouri. So
yeah.
It's just funny.
I have to wonder, almost, like, now that you bring it up, I have to wonder, like, all the women are being so careful to follow Adora's rules.
Right.
And I have to wonder, like, if the men don't feel as beholden to following the rules of like, obey the queen. Sort
yeah,
of,
and maybe you know? that's the, you know, that's maybe that's the tone that she struck, or the sort of, you know, the scene she set is that these guys feel like they can hoot and, you know, hit on Camille, or not hit on, but like, you know, aggress upon her and make weird threats to an armed police officer and scream baby killer at a teenage boy who's grieving his sister. You know, like, they seem very empowered there. And I don't know if I necessarily believe that Adora would work that.
Yeah, I agree. Like, even to the extent of like, you're making a scene that I don't want there to be a scene.
Right,
but
exactly.
If we're, if we're going to go back to that foundational town myth, like that, you know, the silent women and the like, loudly vocal and aggressive men is exactly like what that story is. But, I see what you mean, that Adora wouldn't countenance that. But Adora is distracted, right? Because she sees like, you know, Camille pointedly puts her arm through Dick's, arm, after like, in and around the time that she's telling him about the story of Millie Calhoun, and Camille sees it, or Adora sees it, and she, I love this, she like sends Jodes to run interference. So she's like, basically, Jodes, go distract Camille. And then she invites Dick into her house for the tour. And another little moment that I love about this is like, not only Jackie watches them go inside, but like she interrupts Emma giving a tour of her little house, which is like her little dollhouse. Like, Emma has invited a gentleman to the house. I mean, yes, so that they could take drugs, but also like, she's like, oh, we were just looking at my dollhouse.
Right.
Which is a nice little echo of what, Adora is about to do.
Yeah. And I really like Jackie watching all of this. And there's one loaded Jackie look, or two actually, that come later in the episode that I want to talk about. But, but Elizabeth Perkins doesn't have a lot to say in this episode, but she does a lot.
Oh, she's just looking. And like, I mean, you know, as she said to you in last week's episode, she's like, Jackie knows everything. And like, you really see it in this episode, because like, I don't think we've seen Jackie like on the observation beat as much as we do in this episode, where she's just watching everyone, absorbing it and understanding it in a way that like we, the audience, want to understand what she understands, you know? So she sees what everyone's doing. She knows what all the shit means. And so then we get this like, we get the Katie, well, we got like Kirk Lacey talking to Camille, and we get a little bit better sense of like why he looked at her so oddly at the funeral and looked at her, and left the bar. It feels like guilt. You know, so like he was one of the young men who like, you know, assaulted her, however you want to call it, in the woods. We get that like definitive flash between him and the young boy. So we know that they're the same person. And then he just says like, I've been thinking about you. And it feels like regret, right? Like that's how I read that. As opposed to the other three Jekylls.
And Jackie is like kind of cautious around him, or she's sort of like, you know, it almost seems protective of Camille.
Right.
In that moment. And, you know, so clearly, yeah. But I think that they might be setting up that Kirk is at least a little bit remorseful.
And as with every shot, someone else is watching that. So Katie Lacey, his wife, is watching that. And so like that inspires, I feel like, her later invitation to Camille, where she's like, come over, we'll watch Beaches. And like, she's not dumb. Katie knows exactly the right thing to say. She's like, you'll get a month's worth of articles from us in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And so, which is the only way I could think that like Camille would go to that. But you get another great flash of, you get those girls, a memory of them standing as like a cheer squad. That was a really powerful one, I thought.
Yeah, totally. Just like the way that, you know, like, I don't know. I have old friends that I've been friends with since I was in high school, and like, sometimes I'll look at them and I'll just get a flash of them like at 16 or whatever. You know, just like the way that I just think that like, the valet-isms are very carefully employed in this episode in particular. Like, they're very sparing. He's very sparing with it. It's mostly, like, in real time. Yeah. And I think that, like, it makes me appreciate them all the more.
I'm curious if you have the same read on the Adora, like, Dick house tours I do. There's part of it that's like, let me impress upon you my, like, importance. My wallpaper is hand painted from Paris. My floor dates back to Whenever'sville. But there's also this, like, I don't know, not like seduction, but demand for attention. The way she kicks off her shoes, the way the camera follows her kicking off her shoes before she goes in that room, it feels like she's able to offer him like, because later Camille doesn't even take her shoes off when they have sex, right? So she's able to offer him like more intimacy, slightly more access to her than Camille is able to offer him. And that feels like, you know, she does other shitty things, but that seems to be me, that's a part of it, is like this proffering of some sort of sexual, I don't know, like, pay attention to me kind of thing. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's that. And I think that in that is an expression of power and an expression. It's weirdly, I think, kind of a threat. You know, she's like telling him how old the house is, how special it is, how dangerous the house, like the house is like made of dead animal, you know, animal parts, like, you know, you know, like she's saying, like, do not fuck with this house, meaning do not fuck with me, meaning do not fuck with this town. You know, but also, yeah, being sort of seductive too. Like, I think it's absolutely her recognizing that Camille now has this kind of bond with him, needing to let him know, and her and Camille know, that like, they can't, they're not going to form some sort of bond, Camille and Dick, and, you know, sort of, you know, act
without,
with, you know, act on their own authority, you know,
without her,
like, without her, exactly.
She has to be part of this thing.
In the same way we saw with Emma feeling left out of not knowing about the article, you know, like, this constant reassertion of center, you know, authority and everything is what that seems about to me.
Yeah, and inviting him into the room where, like, Camille is not allowed to go into, you know, is another, it's just awful. And so, yeah, so she calls Camille a rare rose who has her thorns. And she mentions, like, it's true, like, basically later Camille is petrified that her mother is inviting him into the house to be like, did you know my daughter cuts, like, words all over her body and that's her secret shame and she's really, like, messed up and all this sort of stuff like that. She doesn't say that, but she refers to a recent episode, which is sort of about as direct as she get. But she's still, like, the message is, yes, it's one of power, it's one of reassertion into the narrative, but also, like, you know, echoing what Camille said earlier, which is like, I feel like a bad person. And Dora's like, she's fragile, but also she's a bad person. Like, you don't want to mess with her. She's a bad person. You know, it's just, Dora is such a piece of work.
And I think that Dick handles that really well afterward, where he's like, oh yeah, I know a lot. And he pauses and he's like, about that ivory floor. And it's just, it's really great. I don't know if he's withholding that he knows something about her as a sort of means to, you know, sort of use later or whatever, or if he's just genuinely being, like, nice, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's, like, affectionate language in this episode where he's like, you know, the girl I'm seeing or something, you know, the woman I'm seeing. And she's like, oh, we're seeing each other. You know, like, there's cute flirtation that, doesn't feel antagonistic at all. And so I think he's just maybe sort of protecting her or something.
I can't tell if it's like the Messina coming through or what, but I like Dick so much more in the show than I did in the book. You know, and we'll see how that all plays out. But like, I feel like he's been written, as warmer and like he's so savvy. He knows what Adora is doing and he's not, and he's doing his best. Like he's indulging her, because like, you know, he's also looking for information and stuff like that, but he's like firmly on Camille's side. He's like, I'm Team Camille in all of this.
Yeah.
You have my attention. You have my support. Yeah, your mom droned on about her floor. Let's roll our eyes together at your mom.
Yeah, you know, and like, I'm on to her, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think seeing, you know, he's the only outsider in the show, right? I mean, Camille is of that world, so even though she's left it. And he's just basically saying very subtly to Camille, like, oh, don't worry. Like, I know your mom's bullshit, and like, it doesn't affect me. You know, it doesn't work on me. She brought me into her weird, like, womb lair thing. And I emerged, you know, unhypnotized.
Right. I'm no Vickery. I'm no Jocelyn. Like, I'm not going to be taken in by this. Yeah, I guess the only other outsider I would point out is John Keane, who's like,
oh, right. Well, yeah, but he's already been ostracized.
He's a mess in himself. Then we get this like further, like really quick. It's just amazing to me how much room this episode has for like side characters. We get this other wrinkle in the Lacey family drama where we get when Emma takes the stage, we watch Kirk Lacey watch her and we watch Katie Lacey watch him. And so it's not just that Kirk Lacey is paying attention to Camille. It's that like maybe there's something with young girls that we should be on the lookout for with Kirk Lacey. We already saw Emma sort of like coming onto him, but like the way in which he's watching her back, has at least his wife, concerned. Mm-hmm. And then we get this horrible pageant, And this, I think, maybe this is one of the loaded looks that the Jackie looks that you want to talk about, because like Emma notices Camille not paying attention to her, and Jackie notices Emma noticing Camille.
That was the look I'm talking about. Jack, and the look was one of sympathy, I think, but also sort of concern. Like, I don't know, like, I feel like it's still been established that Jackie is on Camille's side. And we kind of tend to think of that as like her on Camille's side against Adora.
Yeah.
But like, maybe she's also on Camille's side against Emma. In, for whatever reason, you know? Not that Emma and Camille are like, you know, enemies or whatever, but like, I don't know. I'm just curious about that Jackie look, because it kind of communicated a lot. Also, we have to mention that there's a great shot of Jackie vaping.
Yes. when we like flash to Emma taking like the Molly with her friends. We then like watch Jackie watching her, and I feel like, you know, Jackie can tell that she's rolling in a way that Adora can't. Mm-hmm. And she's like, that's because I know my way around a substance. And then she just like lets out this puff of vape smoke. And so then that adds, but the rolling aspects adds this like really extra disturbing dimension to this scene where Emma is reenacting a rape, and she's like getting pleasure out of being tied up to this tree because she's like on E. So I don't know. It's
this scene, this play. God, the part when the Union soldiers, who are these gangly teenage boys, have to like close in on her and like sort of thrust at her, like one of
them.
They're
doing like sideways hip sashaying, like wooden. It's
perfectly directed by Valet, like perfectly choreographed for all of its hideousness and its awkwardness. And I also, I mean, I don't know, using like is a weird word, but like I appreciate how he cuts to the three ghouls, you know, the bad men, and they kind of lean forward to really see like how are they showing this, you know. Even though they see this every year, in theory, right? Or is this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's just like a whole grotesque of a scene, but really well staged.
And that's almost like, that reminds me of, there's so much about this story that reminds me of Shirley Jackson, who wrote, among other things, The Lottery. And that, you know, in The Lottery, a lot of, that story was borrowed to use like in The Hunger Games and stuff like that. So think of it as maybe in terms of The Hunger Games, every year there's a tribute. There's a young teenage girl and young teenage boys every year who reenact a rape in front of the entire, who's going to be the Millie this year? Like, of course it's Emma this year, but like, who is going to be the teenage girl chosen to be the representational rape victim in front of everyone? And that almost gives it, and this is something that like, I think Elizabeth Perkins brought up when she was talking to you, because she talked about, she called Adora a witch, and Gillian Flynn also talked about some of like the supernatural feelings around this show, and sort of like that ritualistic aspect of it, of like every year we have to do this rape, because, and that's part of the magic that keeps this town going, is almost what it feels like, to me when I watched it, you know?
Yeah.
And everyone has to witness it. And yeah, those three ghouls have to like lean in and see it. And like, this is part of the power that keeps the town going. But so Emma is ticked off that Camille, isn't paying attention to her. Camille's paying attention to Dick. But if,
I think she's hurt too. I think it's anger and a genuine sort of like disappointment.
Yeah. But if she's mad about that, she's even madder when like Bob Nash goes for John Keane, and everyone's distracted, you know, like Dick and Vickery go running, and even her mom turns her back for like a flat second. And Emma, like, you know, you can see her taking all this in, all this attention directed away from her. And she's, to me, I read that as, I know how I can get attention. And she runs off in the other direction.
Yeah.
And, literally, Adora just turns her back for a second, turns back around, and Emma's gone. And that becomes sort of the focus for the last little section of Calhoun Day. So we get my favorite line reading of the season so far, which is Patricia Clarkson wailing, She never leaves without her phone. No,
she's straight up wailing. Yeah, it's great. It's great.
The hysterics, the Adore hysterics on the porch, as like, you know, Camille reveals that Emma has a second phone and they're all looking for her.
And so she's got Alan's sad fucking Confederate coat on. You know,
she's just like flailing and crying and screaming over the balcony. And it's like
so good.
It's everything you could ever want. And, and so, yeah, so all the men run off into the woods, and then also Camille runs into the woods. And, like, my interpretation of what follows here is that Emma is intentionally drawing Camille, like, deeper into the woods. She's just sort of, like, making sure Camille sees her and then going deeper and then they finally wind up in the hunting cabin. What's your sort of interpretation of what happens?
Yeah, there? I think that's good because, you know, early in the episode, she's trying to have this kind of heart-to-heart conversation, Camille and with Emma, and she brings up the two dead girls. She's like, I know you used to play with them or you know, hang out with them. And she's, so the house kind of, the shack comes into the conversation. And so I think, yeah, it's definitely intentional. You know, she knew that Camille would know where she was going. She wanted Camille to find her.
Right.
You know, it felt very calculated.
So to me, what that means is like when we find her in the cabin and her sleeve is ripped and she's bleeding, like that's something she's done to herself for attention.
Yeah.
She's cut herself for attention. Yeah.
Cut herself. Exactly.
Yeah. And then, so then we get this final pair of scenes. We get, Adora and Camille on the porch, and it's just like masterclass in manipulation of Adora being like, please come sit on the veranda with me. And then I want to apologize to you. And it is not an apology.
No.
It is so wicked. Like, so, you know, Camille cuts her off and apologizes. She's like, I shouldn't have written the article when I did. I'm sorry, Mama. That was like a bad thing to do. And then Dora's like, well, I just want to talk to you about how you're like your father. And that's why I never loved you. And I'm so sorry. I apologize because you're so cold and you're incapable of love. And I'm sorry. And so that's true of you.
And Camille has just told her that she doesn't get close to men.
Yeah.
And Adora's like, well, of course, because, you know, and then she said, I hope that brings you some comfort.
Ah!
Like, so it's crazy
so
town.
So awful.
Yeah.
So awful.
Beautifully performed by both actresses.
Yes.
And also, you know, I kind of was like, oh, she's going to thank her because she rescued Emma, you know, but no, nothing from that.
No.
Yeah. It's a pretty brutal scene. And I think the way that we see Camille react to it, is a credit to Amy Adams and Valet and the writer and Scott Brown who wrote the episode. Like, it's just, it's so not histrionic. It's not screaming. It's just this like slight tremble of a chin, you know, and a watering of the eye. And you know that like internally, this is like the worst thing, you know, one of the worst things that could have been said to her. But she doesn't want to like lose that composure in front of Adora, which is,
but also, yeah. Yeah, I agree with that, but also it feels like a confirmation. She's like, yes, this is what I believe about myself. You are telling me something that I, a fundamental truth I have about myself is that, and like the really cool thing, this is a weird association. I just saw the Mr. Rogers documentary, What Should Be My Neighbor, yesterday. So it's like fresh on my mind. And this thing that Fred Rogers talks a lot about is like at the core of everyone's behavior is this idea of love. And it's not just like the need to be loved, but the need to be able to be loving. And what, Adora is saying to Camille here is like, not only are you like unworthy of my love, I've told you that my whole life, I can't love you, you're unworthy of love, but like you can't even love.
Yeah.
You're not even capable of loving. And I'm taking no responsibility for any of this. That is your father. That is your mysterious father you've never met. And I'm like, when of course Adora is exactly describing herself, she's like, that coldness in you, she says coldly, you know, it's just like so monumentally unfair, hypocritical, cruel, manipulative. But as you say, performed beautifully. And so that brings us to like the word of the episode and the end of the episode, which is this like second sexual encounter with Dick and Camille, where we get like, you know, like full frontal from Chris Messina, but like Amy Adams stays almost entirely clothed. except you like, but her face is like nakedly vulnerable.
Yeah.
And she, you know, insists on having sex her way, the way she feels comfortable. And we just get a flash of her skin. Like I would say in the small of her back, I think. And it says, closer, is what it says, which is the name of the episode. So what did you think of this, like this final sex scene?
I mean, it was pretty intense, you know, and, yeah. And I think it's, I mean, again, not to minimize it, but like entirely unsexy. Like, I mean, I just found it so, there was something just so like urgent, like needy about it and like obviously fraught to it that it's just, I don't know. I thought it was like, the opposite of gratuitous, you know, it's sort of, it felt so necessary to the episode in a strange way. So yeah, I mean, I thought it was well staged, bravely staged by Chris Messina, I must say. There was some hand movement that I don't know that I've ever seen in a, you know, cable television show. Yeah. And then to cut right out on that, you know, with this scene. Yeah. I thought it was, a pretty jarring, but worthy end to a pretty intense episode.
And on that note, let's go to my conversation with Chris Messina.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Hey, Joanna.
We are loving you so much on the show. You're amazing and amazing this episode. So I'm excited.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I love this episode. Things really start to heat up, and I love the tension of this episode. And it was a bitch to shoot because it was a heat wave, and
right.
What started with hundreds of background actors every day, it got smaller and smaller. What they probably started out with was, oh, cool, maybe I'll meet Amy Adams and I get to be in this Amy Adams TV show and be a part of this world. You know, it because of the heat and possibly, you know, the way Jean-Marc shoots, we were all out there kind of baking in the sun. You never really know where the camera's going to be. Amy's a very improvisational director, and I don't mean by language, but by images. So he gets inspired and, you know, go right with the camera and go left and go to this character, that character. And you're on your toes not knowing where that's going to be. So we're all out baking in the sun. In fact, I think some of the extras, had the, taken off set because they had, were either fainted or were about to faint.
Oh my God.
Thankfully, Amy bought an ice cream truck for all of us and made everybody stop shooting and have some ice cream, which was perfect. It was so hot. You just wanted to, you know, to pour the ice cream over your head.
there's this reaction shot you have, where at one point you put your hand above your eyes to literally like shield your eyes from the sun as you're talking. And I was watching that and realizing that that's both such like common human gesture, but also one you just don't often see in film or television, because usually actors have like sunshades over them, so it looks like they're in direct sunlight, but they're not.
Yeah, I like that too. That's in the series, because you don't see that much. I think I had done it for a second, and Jean-Marc liked it, and then asked me to do it again. He loves stuff like that, and always finds moments like that that are real, but sometimes not often seen in a film or TV. I also have to add, we were drinking tons of fake O'Doul's, fake beer, which was O'Doul's. So, you know, besides the heat, you were extremely bloated and gassy. So none of it was really that enjoyable, although, you know, we laughed a lot between takes, and I seeing episode 5, I was super into it.
Well, you mentioned Jean-Marc's sort of unorthodox approach, and everyone that I've talked to for this show sort of mentions how unorthodox his, methods are, but then also mentions sort of a moment where they felt like they could just give themselves over to that and go, well, okay, this is what it is. So this is just how it's going to go, and I'm going to roll with it. Did you have that moment, or were you just on board with his approach from the start?
You know, I was a big fan of his. Since Dallas Buyers Club and Wild and, of course, Big Little Lies. And so I was really excited to work with him. But it did take a moment. It was frustrating because I enjoy a lot of takes and I enjoy trying a lot of different things. And because he doesn't shoot that much, really, like most of the stuff in the series is take one, two, or three. It didn't really go past that for me. And there's no marks on the ground and there's no rehearsal and there's no lights. It was frustrating. It was, I often was coming up to him saying, can I try that again? Or I'd find him at lunch and be like, when we come back for lunch, can we just try one more? And he kind of laughed me off and say like, we got it. You know, what else would we do here? We got it. And eventually, and I'm not quite sure, it happened pretty early for me. I started to, just remind myself how much I loved all his work. And I loved all his suggestions on the day. So I just started to lend myself over to it and say, you know, trust him. He knows what he's doing. Therefore, I think it freed me up. I think sometimes what happens when you have a lot of takes, you can get in your head. I think when you over rehearse things, you start to try to repeat or look for a result, not all the time, but that can happen. And I think he takes the acting away from the actors. And so if you're shooting if you're rehearsing on film, he's catching these raw discoveries. And I think that's what's in the show and in a lot of his work. So I would work with him again in a heartbeat. I thought he was extremely inspiring. Although, I banged my head into a wall trying to get there.
You talked about you mentioned the shifting POVs in this episode. It's really, I agree, completely masterfully done. But what's so interesting to me as someone who's read the book is like the book is so anchored in Camille's head. And I think the addition of your character, the expansion of your character is one of the major ways in which the show shifts out of her head and into your perspective at times. What do you feel like Richard's perspective brings to, I don't know, broadening this world, this universe?
I think that, Richard is, in a way, the audience. And so We want to know about Camille. We want to know about what's haunting her and all the skeletons in her closet. As he turns the investigation onto her, and he starts investigating her, and at first possibly manipulating, and at first, you know, needing of some kind of communication, an outsider in this town where nobody wants him around, nobody's giving him much. And I think it surprises Richard. He don't think he's quite sure, or maybe he's in denial of how much he's starting to like her. So, you know, it was important for me because there's not a lot that comes out about Richard that I came to the project with my own backstory, my own heartbreak, my own skeletons. And that I always thought that Richard was the flip side of the same coin that he of Camille, that he's not in the pain that Camille's in, but he knows that pain and he has his own heartbreak and he's struggling to be seen and heard. You know, he's doing some stupid moves as a detective. He's like 101 detective handbook, you know, don't sleep with the reporter. And I like that about the book. I like that about the script.
Right.
You know, he's making mistakes. He may in Sharp Objects after the eighth episode, he may become a better detective. And I think there are things that he's good at, but he definitely sometimes seems to me that he gets more involved with investigating Camille than the task at hand, which is who killed these two girls.
Right. When you come to a project like that with this whole backstory that you've put together for yourself to inform your moves, is that something that you would share with a scene partner? Like, would you tell Amy about any of this stuff, or would you just keep that as your own private sort of fuel?
Yeah, in the past, I think I've felt the need to share stuff like that. And then sometimes a director or an actor could say like, oh, I didn't see it that way. I saw it like this. And then you start rethinking it or reexamining it. And I, you know, for this particular piece and for this particular moment in my life, I didn't feel a need to share any of that. Everybody has secrets, and I think it's important in a scene to have plenty of them, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, so far, we're only at episode 5, but so far I like your version of Richard so much more than I liked the book version. Was there, just like likability-wise, was there any discussion of you sort of ramping up the warmth on him at all as a conscious choice?
It was important for Richard to be there working, and that he can't just be sitting in a bar drinking, flirting with the reporter. So first and foremost, it was work. And then it was, she's obviously attractive. She's intelligent, and he's an outsider, and she's made herself an outsider. And so there's this instant bond with that. And then there's the manipulation of what, you know, what can you share with me? And then something becomes, like I said, I don't think he's aware of how real it's getting for him. I think he's in over his head, and, you know, I think probably way too soon to say he's falling in love with her, but he's fascinated, and his heart is involved for sure. And I think there's that cliche of, you know, the man feeling that he can save her, help her. And
yeah,
I think he wants to do that. And I think part of the, you know, the backstory kind of feeds into that. He's probably had some bad breakups, and he's probably maybe a man that easily falls in love or lets himself fall in love and wants to find love and wants to not be lonely. And so I think these are traps he's maybe accustomed to. And this one's, it's deeper and it's murkier and more complicated than he's ever imagined it would be.
I wanted to swing back really quickly to some of the like technical aspects of setting up the shots for this day, because you mentioned the shifting perspectives. One of the things that I was most taken by was this thing that Jean-Marc did where he would show you what one character is doing and then show you another character watching that character do that thing, you know, and just sort of like it keeps sort of hop, skipping and jumping out and around. What is the technical approach to doing, you know, say you have Bob Nash drinking and then you need to have Richard watching Bob Nash drinking or something like that. Like, do you have to hang around while he shoots the first and then you move the camera and he shoots you watching, or how does that get put together?
Yeah, he's kind of in that particular episode. He you know, he had a, as a director and, you know, as a crew and cinematographer, most of the time cinematographer has the camera on his shoulder. So, and sometimes that was Jean-Marc. He likes to pop it on his shoulder and shoot some stuff. So they had a very, you know, hard task again in the sweltering heat to just pop around. There was no real, they were also fighting the sun, where the sun was hitting and you know, what looked good, what direction looked the best. And, so they were just kind of like, you know, randomly going around. And so you couldn't, if they were on Vickery, you wanted to be there, for him, for his eye line and, you know, what he was looking at me and Camille doing. You know, there wasn't a lot of downtime, in all the, it was really just like kind of standing out there in the sun, watching them constantly, dance through a huge crowd of people. We were all, you know, frustrated, and you know, it was a taxing few days for everybody. Probably more so for the camera department, who you know is lugging around heavy equipment. But again, you know, when you see the episode, you say it was completely worth the sunburn.
Well, I imagine it must have been relief when you got to shoot the interior scenes inside the house with Patricia Clarkson. But this is also sort of your longest interaction, I think, so far, by far, with Patricia Clarkson.
Yeah.
What is it like working with her in this episode?
You know, she is a friend, and we did Vicky Cristina Barcelona together, as Amy and I did Julie and Julia. So right off the bat, you have a... shorthand, you just cut through all the bullshit. You get into the meat of the scenes. Patty was incredible in that scene through the house. She has a very specific way of working, that, you know, I really admire. And so she said to me, it was one of the greatest acting lessons you can really get. We were outside the house about to go in again. She's got like 5 pages of dialogue where I interject, you know, 3 or 4 times, like a yeah or a thank you or
yeah
or a mm-hmm, you know. And so basically it's a monologue, and then Jean-Marc says, you know, come in the house and tell him about the wallpaper and the staircase or the picture frames or whatever he said to her. Again, there's no rehearsal. There's no marks. And that was really it. And then you'll just lead him up the stairs and then you'll come to the doorway here, you know, and they call rolling, and Patty and I are outside the house, and she says, Chris, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, she
she works in a way where she's not, a lot of actors are like walking around saying it out loud. I could be butchering this, but I don't think she says it out loud at all or very much, if that makes any sense. So it's almost like, you know, when she's saying it, it's happening for the first time. And so she says to me, she said, I don't know what's going to happen. And I said, Patty, well, we're going to walk the tightrope here. And they call action. And she looks at me and she goes, with a big smile on her face, she says, let's fail. And she went up the stairs. She went into the house and she started improvising about the wallpaper. And we went up the stairs and she delivered this 5-page monologue to me. And she was extraordinary. She was beautiful. And I would bet that that's the take they use. We didn't do many more. And it was just a great lesson of relaxation. And, you know, of course, she's incredible in so much of what we've seen of Patty. But the fact that she would be willing to fail and say, who gives a shit? There's no wrong or right here. Let's do it wrong. And if that doesn't work, we'll do it wrong again. And it was one of the great lessons of acting, and maybe for anything in life. Let's fail and take that kind of pressure off ourselves or expectation to be incredible. And I think because she took that expectation off, she was incredible. You know, it really was, you know, between Patty and Amy and Elizabeth Perkins and Matt Craven, it was a masterclass. And the great thing about playing a detective is, what I think I learned is that, you know, a detective is listening and watching and observing and, you know, taking in the body language, her nail polish on her feet, her eye color, and so I got to get a front row seat of just observing these master actors. And that was part of my job, was to just take them in. So ultimately, as a fan, it was an incredible job to have.
And then, of course, I want to talk to you about this final scene that you have where, I don't know, usually when I'm watching HBO, it's like the woman strips down to nothing and the man gets to stay fully clothed, often in a sex scene. What was this reversal like for you in this final scene?
You know, I love that scene because all of what we did was directly in the stage direction. It was right from the writing and it wasn't gratuitous sex. It was character-driven sex. It was how much do people show? What do you want to show? What do you want to see? Power, control. It felt very telling about who these people were and where they are in their lives. Of course, you know, sex scenes are always so strange because there's 40 people off to the side, you know, watching these things.
Right.
And Amy and I would laugh and just make fun of each other, which was good and helpful and just takes away any strangeness. But ultimately, it lacks so much intimacy. It lacks so much. It's not very sexy. There's, you know, and I think in all the sex and Sharp Objects, it's all character based and all, derives from, a pain, a lack of intimacy, and a wanting, a strong desire to be connected to somebody, to something. So I read that and I was like, this is incredible. It's so telling without words of how these two people would behave. I enjoyed it for its bravery.
How do you, there's so much also emotional vulnerability from Amy in that scene. There's just great shot of her face and it's just like so, so raw. How do you as a performer, how are you able to help and support her in that performance?
Well, you know, Amy and I did Julie and Julia together and we became friends and I always wanted to do something else with her besides just eat her food and tell her how delicious it was. And, and I waited and made it and didn't know if it would happen. And then she said, have you ever read this book? And I hadn't. I was a fan of Gillian's and read the book, really wanted to do it. Amy says, Jean-Marc doesn't know you. You come in and read. And I did. And she was like this great friend. Like every time we would read a scene, she'd like turn to Jean-Marc, like, wasn't that great? You know, like she was, you know, being a supportive friend. And, you know, she really fought for me to be a part of this. And I think one of the reasons she did that, and I think she had done it with more than just me, is she wanted to surround herself with people that she trusted and, would be able to go to this dark place and feel supported. And, so, you know, she's an incredible actress, and I'm saying nothing new here. The best thing you can do with Amy is like, let her go and get out of her fucking way because she's so talented. There's really nothing she can't do. And she's a professional. She works her ass off. She loves what she does. And she treats everybody with respect and love. She was a producer on this as well. So, you know, to watch her in these painful scenes, sometimes they would call cut and they would be setting up for another shot. And it was so dark that there was no, and, you know, it was more for her to do that. There was no escaping the kind of cloud over the set or over the scene. And other times, like that end scene in the motel with me and her in episode 5, that they'd call cut and we'd have to just make fun of each other and laugh, you know? So she's very, I don't know if people know this, but she's very funny and she can be very silly and we both get silly together. And that's perfect for this kind of material because it's dark.
When you shoot a scene like that, that is so vulnerable for both of you. What is it then? What's the experience then like watching it with the final cut, with the music that plays over it, seeing how Jean-Marc has put it all together? What is that experience like for you?
Well, it's always painful for me to watch myself because I, you know, and this is probably the reason why some actors, when you hear them say, like, I never see my stuff or whatever, because you can fall into, like, I'm going to now destroy myself and beat the shit out of myself. You can fall into that pretty easy, at least I can. Or there's also the version where you learn a lot about, acting and cinema and, I thought I was doing that and that didn't read, or I thought I was doing too much, but I was doing too little, and on and on and on it goes. So there's always that dance, but with this, I've seen 1 through 7 and I'd have to say, I feel like, Jean-Marc made me better. The actors made me better. The writing made me better. I'm incredibly proud of the show and to be a part of it. That particular sex scene, I didn't realize how it's pretty dark, you know? So that was a kind of a relief, you know, because it, and because you don't know where his camera is. So I wasn't quite sure, you know, trying to stay in the moment, trying to kind of almost forget that there's, you know, 5 guys with equipment in front of me as I'm naked. I wasn't quite sure where that camera was pointing, to be honest, and what it was getting. So, seeing it for the first time, I think I was probably had the feeling of, wow, this is kind of a heartbreaking scene. This is one of the strangest love scenes I've seen, because there's desire and need, and there's like a animalistic kind of need to these people, but it's broken, and it's lacking intimacy, and there's something wrong here. And then in the vain aspect of me was like, I'm so glad that it's pretty dark and that you can't see that that much of me. That's probably better off for me and the show in general. So those were my two thoughts. I've only seen it once, so I'm sure I'll have other thoughts and possibly beat the shit out of myself, as I often do.
I don't think you have anything to beat yourself up over. Yeah, I've seen five.
And did you read the book before?
I did. Yeah, I did.
And do you remember the book like pretty specifically, or did you have enough space between the book and the TV show?
I had a little bit of space, and I've been rereading parts here and there to make sure that I can see sort of what adaptive changes have been made, if that makes sense, because that's just something we want to talk about.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah. So it's fun. Yeah, because I'm not like so in the book that I can't enjoy the TV show as its own thing, but I just always find adaptation so fascinating. I'm just really interested in what feels worth keeping, what needs to be discarded, and what needs to be added. You know, I think that's really interesting. So
it's interesting because if you think of this, if it was a movie and it was 2 hours, you know, what would be, there's so, you know, obviously be so much eliminated. That's what, you know, I love about the kind of 8-hour movie form is the exploration into, you know, you can fill out the town, you can fill out the atmosphere, and you can slow it down.
Right, because the whole Calhoun Day thing is not in the book at all, and so I was just sort of like really interested to see what would happen with this thing that was put together.
And I don't remember it in the book, honestly, but I feel like I've heard Gillian say like Calhoun Day was like a sentence in the book. And then it's amazing, like the writer's imagination to make this whole kind of weird, you know, celebration in this town. It was fascinating.
Yeah.
You know?
Excellent.
So yeah, I hope you keep watching, and I hope you keep enjoying it. I think from my point of view, I loved all of it. And, but I felt like, in terms of like the tension just from five on, just it keeps, marching forward in this really spectacular way. And, and I haven't seen 8, so I watched 7. So now my wife and I have to sit here and kind of, you know, we're like anxiously waiting to see, even though I read it and shot it, how it all wraps up. But, you know,
Are you messaging HBO every day being like, can we get that rough cut of 8 yet, or what's happening? Where is it?
No. You know, I think I should start, though. I think I should start. HBO was kind that they showed me and my wife to 1 and 2 in their screen room, and to see it on a big screen was super cool. Cause he's I hate to sound pretentious here, but he's a filmmaker. It's cinema.
Yeah,
you know,
he
was always making an 8-hour movie. And I think that's what he did with Big Little Lies. He makes these movies. And I think, the idea of having one vision, one director throughout even makes it more cinema rather than, and there's a lot of great shows, tons of them that have, you know, mixed directors, but having one voice, one person helming it is really, I'm really all in favor, because you just have, you know, you have one captain, you know, and whoever that may be, you're kind of that they know the show, they know what we've done, you know. And a lot of times with TV shows, you know, these directors come in and they're terrific and smart and they know the show, but they haven't been there for the first three. And so now they're talking to you about your character, but they haven't really seen it, you know, come to life in that first three. And now they're directing episode four, you know?
Yeah.
So having one voice, I think is beautiful.
No, I completely agree. I completely agree with you. And I like want Jean-Marc Vallée to give us the gift of a TV show, an 8-hour movie every year or every other year, whatever stamina he has for that.
Yeah. So. I don't know how the fuck does he do it? I mean, he did an 8-hour Big Little Lies. I mean, it's like how he did it. And I was concerned, to be honest with you. I was like, how is this guy? Because I loved Big Little Lies and thought, you know, it was fantastic. I was like, how's this guy going to do it again? It's obviously so different. So maybe he will give us one every year.
Yeah, we can only hope. Well, thank you again. And I am looking forward to seeing the rest of the season. All right. Well, that was Chris Messina talking to us about this episode. We want to close out by doing a little book reader spoiler section. Should we lead in again with the pig squeals and the Tupac? I thought it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I thought Dave, our producer, did a great job with that. I mean, I guess we could change up the song to like Perry Como or something, but like, I don't want Dave to really, you know, stress himself out.
Each week a new Hog Heat remix. No, let's just go with Tupac and the pigs and
imagine, you know, Jackie vaping to that sound. Like she,
yes.
Like.
If we miss something again this week, please email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Please be nice to us when you do it. That would be nice. But otherwise we will see you next week after the spoiler section. You all appreciate it. All right. Well, so like the first thing I want to talk about is how incredibly well I think they're doing the floor stuff.
Yeah. Well, actually, I first want to say, going all the way back to the beginning of this episode with the Ashley thing, the reason we didn't pay attention to it is because it doesn't fucking matter. unless they change the ending of the story, which we should be conscious of course. We don't want to accidentally spoil something by omission. You know, you can spoil by omission probably. Anyway. But yes, the floor stuff, very well done. Not too goofy or heavy handed. I think they're setting that little reveal up nicely.
I know they laid in the themes of the floor. I feel like if I were watching this show and didn't know the ending, I wouldn't be like, why are they spending so much time on this floor? I'd be like, yes, all of this makes sense in terms of like how ostracized Camille feels and the history of the house and like Camille's power. I mean, Adora's power and all this sort of stuff. Like, I'm really impressed with the floor stuff every single time and all the shots of it, which will help us visually later, you know, all of that. So, and if you're listening to the spoiler section and, you haven't read the books, the reason the floor is important is because in Emma's dollhouse is like where all the teeth of the girls that she's killed have gone to make the ivory inlay floor. So it's a whole thing. You know, ever since I watched Breaking Bad, I shouldn't have needed Breaking Bad for this, but I know it's a bad thing when you have a second cell phone. So, you know, if I learned anything from Walter White, the fact that Emma has a second cell phone, the things she says, she, or Camille goes, do you have Anne and Natalie in there? And Emma, like, her head shoots up. Like, I'm guessing there are photos of the dead girls on her phone. Would be my guess. But you know, like, and Camille means something more innocent by it, but Emma's like, what the fuck? Oh, you mean something else.
But if there are, but the story still ends the way it ends, like, no one will see them because they'll find out when she goes to school, right?
Well, they'll find out when she goes to St. Louis. I guess, like, she'll go back to St. Louis. I think, I bet if there are photos on the phone, they'll find them at the very end, right, as sort of like collection of evidence or something, right, like that. Right, right. Like I alluded to earlier with Vickery saying like good tree, bad apple, like, I'm like, I would say Camille is the only good apple on that bad tree. So like, strike that reverse of Vickery again. You're wrong. The white dress that Emma gives her, my guess is that's the dress she wore, like the whole woman in white thing.
Right.
I didn't think about that until the second time through, but I'm guessing that that's like the dress she wore to lure, you know, a young girl into the forest. So, we might see that dress again, on Emma. Cause I was like, the second time through, I was like, why does she have another white dress? It's not the one that she's wearing. Why does she have this other dress? And then I was like, oh, that's her child napping dress.
Yeah. Well, we all have our crime costumes.
Yeah. Yeah. Mine, I like to dress as the Hamburglar, of go. McDonald's fans. Yeah. So, you know.
And I put on one of Jackie's caftans and grab my vape pen and get going.
Oh my God. The caftan plus the hair, like Jackie is just amazing.
So good.
Ugh. All hail Elizabeth Perkins. Okay. And the last thing I want to say is that, oh, Katie Lacey inviting Camille over for beaches. I guess I didn't want to say this in the episode because I guess it counts as like a gentle spoiler. But like, if they follow the book, Camille will be going over to Katie Lacey's house. And that was like probably either my favorite or second favorite scene from the book, because this, viper's nest sort of situation of Camille going into this house where all these women hate her, and the way in which it turns on her is, I thought, was like really incredible and relatable. And so, I mean, not that I've like gone home and had a bunch of like old cheerleaders from my high school invite me over and like turn on me, but like, I don't know, it feels really, really relatable. But then again, like this whole season has done a lot to make the whole like coming home thing feel relatable, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. Also, I mean, we didn't really get any indication either way from this episode, but do we think she's still gonna sleep with the boy?
I mean, I think so. And it's like, I don't know how we're gonna get there.
We only have time.
Like three more episodes, but I think it's just that like, her feeling bad, like she feels like a bad person when she's home. And John Keane is, I think, gonna like approach her and be like, I feel like a bad person all the time here. Mm-hmm. And she's gonna see herself in that. And as I was sort of like trying to, when you brought up like the outsider that she relates to, like that John Keane represents the, right, only other thing, you know? So like, I think so. Have we like done a good job of, making sure everyone understands like how old John is, that he is at least like 18, right? Not that that makes sense.
I don't know that we
I know.
Yeah. Oh,
he just does seem very boyish. There's another John scene from the, book that I have to wonder if we're going to get. Emma has mentioned, I think, a couple times, like how she thinks that John like fancies her. And there's a scene in the book where like, that Camille goes over there and all the girls are in the pool and John is like watching Emma. And the reason that he's watching Emma is he like suspects Emma, but like, I don't know. It's complicated. I don't know if we're going to get it, but, we'll see. John Keane, I'm still like sort of waiting to feel like I need a few more layers peeled back on John Keane before I feel like I really understand. This episode didn't give him much to do except like brood sweatily in a vest and look uncomfortable. You know, which is plenty. It's plenty to do. Yeah. And I really loved Ashley's dress.
Yes.
I guess.
Yeah.
Doesn't, it was like classy, but like too short at the same time.
Yeah. Somehow like, Ashley so finds good. A way.
Ashley finds a way. All right. Where can people find you on the internet until we talk about the next week's episode?
Buried under my bedroom floor, which is made of dolphin bones.
Ooh.
Also vf.com. How about you?
You can find me scrubbing all the bloody stains off of Ashley's floor in as Lady Macbeth of fashion as I possibly can. You can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, and we will see you next week.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.